Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
I'm Steve Wills, one of the hosts of the New Books in East Asian Studies series. My guest today is Chad Deal, an assistant professor of East Asian history at Loyola University, Maryland, and the author of Resurrecting Nagasaki, Reconstruction and the Formation of Atomic Narratives, published by Cornell University Press in 2018. Chad, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you so much, Steve. I'm really excited to be here and to talk with you about my book.
Before we start talking about the book, could you just tell us a little bit about your background as a historian and the origins of this book project in particular?
Yeah. I started studying Japanese as an undergraduate at Montana State University, where I grew up. And my Japanese teacher at the time, Yuko Hara, encouraged me to go study abroad. So when I was studying abroad in Kumamoto as a junior, I decided to visit Nagasaki. It was just a few hours away by bus. And when I was visiting Nagasaki, I had to go see the Atomic Bombing Museum. And when I was there at the museum, there was an exhibit all about the Christians, and especially the Catholics of Nagasaki. And I was really interested in the history of that. So when I was leaving the museum, I stopped by the bookstore and picked up a book in Japanese by an author named Nagai Takashi, who actually appears in my current book quite a bit. And I wanted to read it to practice my Japanese and to become more familiar with the experience of people who survived the atomic bombing. And there was a chapter called Providence, as in God's providence. And in that chapter, Nagai Takashi talks about how the atomic bombing of the Urakami region, which is northern Nagasaki, where the Catholics, the largest Catholic community was, he said that that region was chosen as, or was destroyed by the atomic bomb because it was chosen as a sacrifice on God's altar in order to end the Second World War. And when I read that, I thought my Japanese must be terrible because how can anybody interpret such destruction in such a way? And so it led me to continue researching it once I went back to Montana State University. And I wrote a senior thesis under Brett Walker, also a Japanese historian. Brett Walker actually encouraged me to continue doing the research on Nagasaki, which took me back to Nagasaki on a Fulbright graduating research fellowship to live in Nagasaki for 1 year. And while I was there, I decided to begin making a career out of this, and I applied to graduate school. Luckily, got into Columbia, went to Columbia to work with Carol Gluck, and developed this into a dissertation. Went back to Japan several times for research, and eventually completed my dissertation, and which was basically the first draft of this book, as it is for most people. It finally is out. So,
and congratulations! And it's a real accomplishment. It's incredible to hear that this was something that was so consistent for you, an interest that goes back to your undergraduate days, and you really followed it through.
Right. Thanks. Yeah, I didn't think of it that way, but yeah.
Yeah, that's great. I wonder if you could tell us also a little bit about the main sources you relied on for this project.
Yeah, sure. So because this is the first, to my knowledge, the first English language historical monograph on the atomic bombing of Nagasaki and its aftermath, I really wanted to look, or I was sort of forced to look outside of directly Nagasaki books. And Sorry, Steve, I'm just going to start that part over because...
Yeah, no problem.
I had a total brain fart, but...
Pretend I just asked the question again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so the material for this book, I wanted the book to be largely primary source driven for a number of reasons, but one reason is that I just came across such abundant archives in Nagasaki and elsewhere, and for example, out of the thousands and thousands of photographs that I took of the sources, I've only been able to use a fraction of a percentage. So I really wanted to make those sources drive the book. Another reason the book is so primary source driven is that, to my knowledge, my book is one of the first, or if not the first, English language historical monograph on Nagasaki and its aftermath. So I didn't have a lot of peer monographs to draw from or to speak with. There are a lot of books on Hiroshima, obviously, and I bring that up as an issue in my introduction, but I felt like whenever I wanted to engage in those books, they were pulling me in directions I didn't want to go. And so when I do use secondary source material, it's largely outside of the field of Japanese studies. I do some urban history. There's some memory studies authors in there. But again, the book is largely primary source driven. And I'll go ahead. Did you have a question?
Yeah, sure. I was just wondering, can you tell us about some of the archives that you visited and what kind of collections you were dealing with?
Yeah, there was one archive in particular, which probably the bulk of my primary sources come from. And that was the archival room of the Nagasaki City Nagai Takashi Memorial Museum. And it is... It's a museum dedicated to the memory of Nagai Takashi, whom I mentioned before, and it's run currently by his grandson, Tokusaburo. And when I was doing research in Nagasaki on the Fulbright Graduating Senior Fellowship, I met Tokusaburo and I visited the museum many, many times, but I wasn't given access to the archival room. He keeps it closed, so it's not open to the public at any time. And that was in 2003, 2004. And then when I went back for my dissertation research in Tokyo, I visited Nagasaki a few times, and I think it must have been early 2008. So Nagai's grandson, Tokusaburo, asked me if there were any primary sources, archival material that I would like to see. And my eyes just sort of got really big, and I was like, yes, absolutely. And,
sure.
And so we scheduled a time, and he just opened the door to the archives and just let me look at anything I wanted. And there were just shelves and shelves of correspondence and newspaper clippings and art and manuscripts of Spanish translations of books that were never published, and just a really rich archive. And so I just spent as much time as I could photographing all of this material. And so that's the majority of the primary source material.
Yeah. So after 5 years, you finally gained access to the treasured archive.
Exactly. And I was very patient, but he was really generous in letting me see anything I wanted. And I should probably explain why that is that, and maybe this will come out in our discussion later, but Nagai Takashi is a pretty controversial figure within Japan in terms of the way he interpreted the atomic bombing as, a gift from God. And so some scholars have criticized him pretty brutally. And so his grandson now sort of tries to at least avoid that as much as possible. And so once he realized that I was going to take an objective look at the post-war history of Nagasaki, I think he, not that he told me I couldn't criticize him, and I do in certain ways, but I think he felt like I was going to give the history a fair shake. And so I think I just gained his trust after 5 years.
So you just, you proved yourself after a while. Yeah. Well, I just want to say that your immersion in a really wide variety of rich primary sources, it just comes through on every page of the book, and it's one of the real pleasures of reading it.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I appreciate
and
that.
And I think that's probably a good segue to talking about the book itself. So I thought we might as well start logically enough with the introduction. And I'd like to commend you, first of all, on your poetic creative titles for every chapter.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, and I want to just riff off of the title of the introduction just for a second. The introduction is called Valley of Visions. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I interpreted the title was the idea that there are, you know, within the valley there, there are many different conflicting visions of what a post-war, post-bombing Nagasaki should look like, how the city's identity should be defined, and of course, how the city should commemorate the bombing and its aftermath. And if that's not a complete misreading there, I wonder if you could sort of talk about, you know, who were the different groups that held those visions and, you know, that had the most significant influence on that Reconstruction discourse?
Yeah, sure. And that's exactly what I meant by it. So I'm just glad that it was read that way. There were, I would say there were four main groups of people that are at the center of the book. Firstly, the city officials, including the mayor, or actually I discussed several of the mayors, city council members, other city officials who work for like the Nagasaki City Construction Office and other things like that. So that's one of the main groups, and they're the main focus of chapter one. Although all of my groups appear in all the chapters, but the main focus of chapter one are these municipal officials. Secondly, the Catholic community of the Urakami region of Nagasaki. And so Urakami was ground zero of the atomic bombing. And this is where the largest community of Catholics resided. And they become a major voice during this Reconstruction period. And some of the individuals I discuss within that community are, of course, Nagai Takashi, whom I've mentioned, and also Bishop and eventually Archbishop Yamaguchi Aijiro, and there are other Catholics I discussed throughout. They're the main subject of Chapter 3, really, and that's the chapter on Nagai Takashi and his works and the Catholic community's influence on the image of Nagasaki, post-atomic Nagasaki. And then one of the other major groups is the survivors of the atomic bombing, and I focus mostly on the survivor activist groups. The survivors today are generally referred to in Japanese with the word hibakusha, but the hibakusha term itself came about in the late 1950s as a legal designation for survivors for the purposes of compensation and medical relief, help with paying medical costs and things like that. And in order to qualify as a legal hibakusha, you had to submit an application and get a booklet. And this will evolve slowly over the decades after 1957. But so my use of the term hibakusha, which I use quite a bit in the book, I do explain my usage of it, but it is a bit anachronistic to refer to the immediate post-war survivors with the term hibakusha. There were a lot of other terms used to refer to the survivors, like seizonsha, higaisha, senseisha, etc. But as a group, I look at mostly the activist groups that were driven by the survivors, and they are the main subject of chapter 5. But of course, they appear throughout the entire book. And I should also say that all of the groups of people that I've just mentioned, the city officials and the Urakami Catholics, most of them are also survivors of the atomic bombing, but the survivor activists had a different vision of post-atomic Nagasaki, which we might be able to talk about later. And lastly, the last major group that I discuss in the book, or at least until 1952, is the presence of U.S. occupation personnel. And there's sort of two groups within that category. One is the occupation officials of within Nagasaki, the Nagasaki military government team. And then there's the they're the main subject of chapter two. And then chapter four deals with the censorship apparatus and sort of the censorship aspect of the U.S. occupation. So those are the four main groups, and they appear again throughout the whole book.
Sure, it's so interesting to see the different groups sort of vying with each other for influence over this very complicated reconstruction process. And I really appreciate your point that it's a misconception to treat them as discrete groups because there's so much overlap, and that's a good point to keep in mind throughout the book. Of course, another focal point of the introduction is where you draw a contrast between Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that's a recurring theme throughout the book as well. And you know, it's startling to think that this really is one of, if not the first, you know, book length English language study of Nagasaki post-war, post-atomic reconstruction. So, of course, we're grateful to you for this contribution. But I wonder what you would have to say about what we have missed out until now because of this tendency to overlook Nagasaki.
Right. I guess I should start by saying there have been other books about post-war Nagasaki, but they're more of like journalistic accounts, and they generally follow the same format where they follow a few or five of the survivors, and they weave their stories throughout some of the history. But what I'm trying to do is take an analytical approach to understanding the reconstruction. What can it tell us about post-war history of Nagasaki, especially compared to Hiroshima? And I think, so one of the reasons I originally chose to focus so much on Nagasaki was that I kept asking myself, you know, why? Oops. Sorry, I'm just going to take a quick mental break.
They
can delete that. Yeah. What was the last part of the question
again? What we're missing out on?
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. By not focusing on. I forgot what my. What did I just finish saying? My brain is so fried. They're the other books on Nagasaki. But then when I looked beyond these journalistic accounts, there were no books that really interrogated the aftermath of the Nagasaki atomic bombing from a historical analytical perspective. And all the books that dealt with the atomic bombings, in all fields that I could find, all the books that dealt with the atomic bombings from an analytical perspective focused primarily on Hiroshima. Even if they said that they focused on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the atomic bombings plural, they usually would just use Hiroshima as an example of something that could be applied to both cities. And I didn't feel like that was really satisfying enough. But I guess the question that sort of drove me was, why is it that Hiroshima is so much focused on and Nagasaki is not? And that was actually a question during my first year of graduate school, which really set me off on my research, was trying to answer that question. And I realized that it could only be found in this early post-war reconstruction period and how the two cities reconstructed. And so by doing that, I realized that, you know, the focus on Hiroshima really prevents us from understanding the full history as much as possible of the atomic bombings, because it really is only one half of the story. There were two cities destroyed by atomic bombings. And the main thing to remember is that Nagasaki's response to their atomic bombing was significantly different from Hiroshima's response. And if you don't ever look at Nagasaki separately from Hiroshima, you'll miss that, is sort of what I was realizing through my research. And so that's your question, I guess.
That's so interesting. If I'm understanding... It's not that it's a mere oversight that Nagasaki has tended to be left out, but it's connected to the history of the reconstruction itself, in that especially the municipal leaders that you write about in the first chapter make this conscious decision to suppress the memory as much as possible, in contrast to Hiroshima's decision to sort of foreground its status as an atomic bomb city.
Right. Right. And I think, sorry, Steve, it'll come back to me in just a second. Cause I really like your comment there. Yeah, it was really, yeah, it was never, you know, satisfying for me to answer the question, why is Hiroshima so much, more studied? It was never satisfying for me to answer, oh, because it was the first atomic bombing. It really did go back to this early Reconstruction, Harry. It really did go back to the early Reconstruction period, where you had the two cities embracing different paths of Reconstruction. So Hiroshima did make the atomic bombing the central part of its urban identity, which they were very good at promoting themselves as the atomic bomb city, whereas you have Nagasaki, on the other hand, choosing a very different path of Reconstruction, where they chose to revive their historical past as their international past as a, you know, this international port city. And so they really branded themselves as an international history rather than simply an atomic bomb city. And I wouldn't want to go too far and say that, and I try to be really careful about how I phrase this in the book, but so the municipal officials did promote that historical urban identity of the city over their present situation, which was, you know, immediate aftermath of atomic destruction. But they couldn't completely ignore the fact that they had been destroyed by an atomic bomb, and it would have to fit somewhere in their narrative. And so they do promote to some degree the atomic bombed identity of their city as well, but only insofar as it sort of complements their own.
Sure. Well, that's a perfect segue into talking about the first chapter, where you talk about what you call the municipal vision of Reconstruction. That's really the sort of vision for the city's post-bombing identity and future that's most actively promoted by the various city officials that you were mentioning before. So how would you describe the sort of basic outlines of that vision? What did they foresee? What were they trying to create?
Right. So in a way, you can say that the response of the municipal officials to the destruction was quite natural. You want to rebuild what was lost. And so that's exactly what they set out to do, is to design reconstruction plans and, that revived their past history, a history that they felt they could be proud of, especially in the immediate post-war period when they couldn't sort of play up a lot of the immediate history of the city as a site of Mitsubishi shipbuilding that built the battleship Musashi and things like that. And so they went back farther and said, you know, what sort of history can we really emphasize in our reconstruction? And so they went, back hundreds of years. And so their main vision of reconstruction was to, you know, cultivate an urban identity of the city based on their past as an international trading port. I call it the municipal vision of reconstruction because it was really the municipal officials who drove this vision, but it was promoted not only by mayors and other officials, but also by representatives of the city like Nagai Takashi, who was Catholic, and even the U.S. occupation in Nagasaki, the Nagasaki military government team. They also promoted this image of Nagasaki and this vision of reconstruction. So
it wasn't that one group that had a monopoly on this particular vision, which makes sense.
Right.
How successful would you say the champions of this municipal vision were over the long term?
Yeah, how successful were they? Well, I guess I spend the rest of the book. So the first chapter is, you know, sort of defines this vision and the main players in it. And then I spend the rest of the book sort of showing how that unfolded over the following years and decades and how it influenced the urban identity of the city. And we see that, you know, when my book ends in the late 1950s, in chapter six, we see how it's affecting to the land, affecting the architectural landscape of the city to the detriment of the collective memory of the atomic bombing survivors. And so, I'd say in that sense, you know, they're continuing to have success. And then,
but of course, it's a success that's we have to qualify in the way we conceive of it as success, because it's right. It involves stamping out other people's priorities and interests.
Yeah, and I should add that the meaning of this municipal vision to construct this city of international culture, the term that they use in Japanese is kokusai bunkatoshi, which, you know, can literally mean international culture city or international city of culture. But the municipal officials, as I talk about in chapter six, were able to add nuance to that definition to, instead of putting focus on international culture, they put the focus on international city. And so they wanted to, or they redefined their own vision to suit the needs of the late 1950s, which by then they wanted to be an international city, which for them meant, and I know I'm getting ahead of us, but by that time it meant, you know, having a clean urban landscape free of ruins of war or anything like that. And so the atomic bombing ruins no longer fit their municipal vision, which they had at first, because even though I know I spent a lot of time saying, you know, they were trying to overwrite the immediate memory of the atomic bombings, they did still see the importance of commemorating the atomic bombing to a limited degree. And so they would preserve certain ruins like the cathedral ruins, subject of chapter six. But once the municipal vision sort of evolves, the meaning of what that vision entailed, once that evolves, then other narratives sort of, I still have a brain fart. Sorry. But once that vision of reconstruction evolves, then the other groups sort of lose their voice.
So it's not to say that this municipal vision is necessarily hegemonic or, you know, eliminates all other voices, because as you discuss in detail throughout the book, this municipal vision seems to sort of set the parameters, and it sort of sets the tone of the discussion.
Right.
It's what the different activists and different groups have to sort of resist or try to work within.
Yeah, absolutely. And you put that much better than I could. Thanks.
I think it's so interesting. You mentioned the sort of ambiguities of this term, the kokusai bunka toshi, and how it can even be, because of the sort of, you know, flexibility of Japanese grammar, how it can even be translated in English in ways that
exactly.
have serious differences.
Yeah.
You have this great, I love your sort of epigraphs too, the one quote from a city construction office chief, I can't even comprehend what the devil is meant by international cultural city. So,
yeah, that was one of the problems immediately after they got the official go-ahead from Tokyo to have a reconstruction law officially named the Kokusai Bunkatoshi Kensetsuho. Some people were like, wait, what does that even mean? because that wasn't the plan, but B, and I mentioned this in the book, is some city officials looked up Kokusai Bunka in the dictionary or the encyclopedia, and I found nothing.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, there's a lot of confusion immediately after, but they just sort of, you know, went with it. So
sure. And then in decades to come, they ended up sort of ad hoc defining what that term would ultimately mean. And now we're left with this idea of an international cultural city, of which Nagasaki may be just one example.
Yeah, exactly. And I like how you mentioned earlier that it was really this vision of reconstruction defined officially from 1949 as the international cultural city vision. It really dominated the discussion and became the framework within which all the other narratives had to operate. All the other voices had to, you know, participate in the discourse, whether or not they liked it or not, or whether they liked it or not. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. Well, it's a fascinating topic. And of course, you know, we have to keep in mind that any discourse that's taking place in the late 1940s in Japan, or as you said, up until 1952, it's those discourses are all taking place in the context of the post-war occupation.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You shift to that topic mainly in the second chapter, and then right. comes back again in later. And so maybe we can kind of combine our discussion of the two here. But how would you mentioned earlier the sort of local occupation authorities. There's a Colonel Victor Del Nor, for example, who takes yeah. on a really prominent role. How would you characterize their influence? What were their objectives, methods, and right. so on?
Victor Del Nor, this is an interesting story because so he was the head of the occupation in Nagasaki for a couple of years, and he has had the most impact in this. Or sorry, let me start that part over.
Sure.
So Victor Del Nor is a really interesting story for a few reasons, but. So he was the head of the occupation in Nagasaki for a couple of years, but he's had a long lasting impact on the city. They recently, I think it was a couple of years ago, finally named a street after him called Derenowa Dori. And they actually initially wanted to name the street after him when he was still there or when he was about to leave. But he's very beloved in the city, and he still is to this day. And he only appears a little bit in the chapter. I drop his name a lot, but his story only appears a couple pages in the chapter, I think. And it was really unfortunate because this is one of those things where you're working with deadlines with the publisher, and you come across archives that you unfortunately can't use. And so the Gordon Prang collection at University of Maryland, one of the best sources on the occupation of Japan. Victor Del Nor's daughter donated a lot of his material from his time in the city. And I was told about it right before I was completing the revisions for the book. And so when I looked at it as much as possible, and it was just so much material, and it was so rich that I just couldn't really put it in the book. So I put as much as I could in the book. And a lot of the photographs from his time there are from this collection. But by and large, he's so beloved because he was so supportive of the city's reconstruction. And I think, I don't think this is, an odd case or anything, but so the occupation of the city, like it was throughout Japan, was really there to, they're there as a military occupation, but they're also there to help Japan physically rebuild. And so that's what the occupation in Nagasaki did. But when it came to supporting the official path of reconstruction, they were right there with the city officials. And so they were one of the biggest supporters of this, what I call the municipal vision of reconstruction. And I have a really fun picture in the book of Victor Del Nor and at a cocktail party with a bunch of the city and prefectural officials, and they're just having a great time. But I just sort of put that in there to really capture the mood of what it was like between the two.
Yeah, you can really tell in your discussion that there tended to be a really constructive relationship between the occupation authorities and the Nagasaki officials overall. When did they come into conflict? Where were some of the areas where they maybe disagreed with each other?
Is this meant to move into chapter four, kind of?
Well, I mean, we could do that.
Yeah, because it is. I'm trying to think of.
I just wonder because we have to assume that the occupation officials didn't have exactly the same priorities.
Right.
And objectives as the municipal authorities did. And I just wonder, it seems that in general, they were pretty simpatico, but were there times when there were particular sort of hot button issues where suddenly that constructive relationship became a little bit more tense or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. I think Once another group of American personnel came into the city, they actually came into both Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but the Atomic Bombing Casualty Commission, I think I'm getting too sidetracked on that.
Okay.
I think I know what you're asking. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Stevie. I don't think I can answer that very well.
Okay, that's
okay. We'll have to eliminate that.
Yeah, that's okay. Let me. Sorry. No, let me. Let's just take a.
I could say something because I was thinking of, you know, there's an area where you think they would not agree, but mm-hmm. On the local level, the Nagasaki military government team was actually very supportive of survivors publishing mm-hmm. when the national allied government was not. Mm-hmm. So,
okay, so maybe it's the best way to talk about this is bringing in some of the stuff from chapter 4 about the censorship and things like that.
Okay.
Sorry. So let's just see. So in general, it sounds like there was a really constructive, open relationship between the local officials of SCAP and the municipal officials who were mainly pushing for that particular vision of reconstruction that you mentioned in the beginning. And maybe we can start to see some of the areas where they didn't always agree or where they sometimes came into conflict in some of the material you discuss in chapter 4, where in particular you talk about the publishing industry and the role that mm-hmm. the occupation played in shaping what was considered an acceptable narrative of the bombing.
Yeah, right. And that's, you know, this, you know, I kind of talk about this group of American occupation personnel as taking a very different approach to interacting with the people from Nagasaki. And interestingly enough, the officials in Nagasaki, so the American officials, so Victor Delnor and other officials were actually very supportive of survivors publishing their accounts. And so they'd write them letters of support to the censors to try to get them published, and it didn't always work. And Victor Delnor, especially, you know, in his letters of support, he would say, you know, these stories, essentially these stories of atomic destruction are really crucial for our own understanding in this new nuclear age, et cetera. But when it came to the national level, at least the American occupation government in Tokyo, they had a very different view of that. And there, you know, there are some really good books on censorship during the Allied occupation. And there's one good, really good book of censorship of the atomic bombings specifically. But this was, you know, the survivors of both Nagasaki and Hiroshima met with a lot of pushback and censorship from the American occupation. And this is something I try to argue in chapter 4, was that it wasn't so much a complete blanket censorship of everything and anything to do with the atomic bombings, but the content was important, but also whether the publication was meant for local consumption or national consumption was also a factor in this. So you do see a lot of local books that deal in some way with the atomic bombings being published with quite ease, especially from 1947. But if they're intended for national readership, then censorship was much more intense.
Yeah, and one of the really interesting parts of chapter 4 is you have the different sort of memos and communiques between different occupation censorship officials, sort of one approving a text and another disagreeing, and the sort of back and forth that you trace in that chapter is so interesting to read. There's not a sort of single occupation view of what's considered an acceptable narrative.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was something John Dower called a phantom bureaucracy. It was, a lot of these censors weren't on the same page. Like you mentioned, one censor could be like, wow, this is good. There's nothing objectionable. And then the next one would be like, are you crazy? This is terrible. We can't publish this. But and one of the things I discuss in that chapter is that the censorship apparatus evolves throughout the occupation. The subject of censorship evolves, the methods evolve. I just really tried in that chapter to complicate our understanding of occupation period censorship, especially as it dealt with the atomic bombings, but also in general.
And one of the sort of specific case studies that you bring in that chapter and in a way this is putting the cart before the horse, is one of the most representative texts associated with the author Nagai Takashi, you discussed in the previous chapter. And we'll come back to him in just a second. But while we're on this topic of censorship, how did ultimately the Bell of Nagasaki is approved and ends up having quite an influence on, you know, our understanding of the bombing. But how would you say the occupation officials shaped the final product of the Bell of Nagasaki?
Yeah, right. One of the things I mentioned about censorship in general, and a lot of other scholars have discussed this, but how censorship causes people to create things they otherwise would not have created. And so you see this with the final product of the Bell of Nagasaki. And I should probably say something about, I keep saying singular Bell of Nagasaki. Yeah, the original title Nagasaki no Kane is in reference to a single bell, so it's not plural like it's generally translated. But at any rate, so the final product, so in 1948, when the censors were discussing things, it went all the way up to General Willoughby, and he decided. The official decision was to just hold on to the book, not outright. Ban it from being published, but to just hold on to it until a decision could be made, which was the first case of, which is in itself a form of censorship. But and as one of the censors recounted in this documentary film I watched, was that he said he thought it was pretty slick. That's his words, because they had never done that before. Just hold on to it. And so when they eventually did say that it could be published, they said it could only be published if Nagai Takashi and his publisher agreed to add an appendix describing it was actually an official military report about the Japanese atrocities in the Philippines, in Manila. And at first there was some pushback from Nagai and his publisher, but they acquiesced and they agreed to the appendix. So in that sense, they affected the final product in the hope that, you know, showing Japanese atrocities during World War II would justify in some way the atomic bombings in general, but it sort of has the opposite effect. Other people have pointed out as well, is that they're equating, you know, Japanese atrocities and the atomic bombings. And so, you know, now, you know, after the book was published, they were like, oh shoot, now people are going to, you know, feel justified in saying the atomic bombings were an atrocity.
So it ends up cutting both ways.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, that's a fascinating subject, and it's probably a good time to shift the focus back to the author himself, Nagai Takashi, the saint of Urakami, who plays such a central role in this whole discourse and is such a striking character. Can you tell us a little bit about his background and his sort of important contributions to this discourse?
Yeah, sure. He was born in 1908 in Shimane Prefecture, so he was not a Nagasaki native. He moved there to attend medical school, and he encountered Catholicism when he moved to Nagasaki University. To Nagasaki to attend medical school, because the medical school was right in the Urakami Valley, and he got to know some of the locals, and especially he got to know the Moriyama family really well, and they were descendants of the hidden Christians. And I think he actually lived with them at one point before he converted, but he eventually, he became an army medic and went abroad after the Manchurian incident. And then again, after the outbreak of the Second Sino-Japanese War in 1937. And when he was abroad, the daughter of the Moriyama family, Midori, who eventually will be his wife, sent him a lot of Catholic texts, and he sort of got really interested in Catholicism. And when he came back, this is after the Manchurian incident, so before the outbreak of total war, he came back and he converted to Christianity, Catholicism, but this will end up. So his experience abroad, during the conflicts, and then especially during the Second Sino-Japanese War, he'll be abroad in northeastern China, as an army medic, and he'll read these texts and watching all this death and destruction on the battlefield and reading his Catholic texts, he starts thinking deeply about, you know, the meaning of, you know, death and things like that. And this is where he starts first forming this idea that, you know, all death is due to the will of God, and which he'll eventually, as I already talked about, he'll eventually apply that to the whole destruction of Nagasaki. But so he was in Nagasaki when the U.S. dropped the bomb on the city in 1945, and his wife was killed immediately. His children survived. He, in the months after the bombing, he was already a leader in the Catholic community, as like he was a parishioner representative, and he was really a voice that the Catholic community really listened to. And so after the bombing, they looked to him for support, like moral and spiritual support, because they were really questioning their faith in God, and you know, and their, you know, how could, you know, how could their loved ones be killed and they were remained alive? So a lot of survivor guilt and things like that. And so they looked to him for an answer, you know, how do you explain this horrible destruction that was dealt upon us? And there were some other issues that I mentioned in the book, like other parts of Nagasaki were saying that the Catholics had been destroyed because they were sinners, and or they didn't pay, they didn't come visit the Shinto shrines, and they were being punished by God. And so he, you know, he took his understanding of death and destruction and applied it to the entire atomic bombing as sort of this moral, moral and spiritual support mechanism for his community. And so he said, no, it's not divine punishment. It's divine providence. You know, God chose us because he loves us. We're sacrificial lambs on the altar to end the Second World War. And so that idea, you know, just to jump into chapter four again, the censors really liked that because it sort of took the responsibility of the atomic bombing out of the hands of the U.S. and put it in the hands of God. You know, oh, it wasn't us. So, yeah, that's sort of how he came to say what he did. And he died a few years later in 1951 from leukemia, which he had contracted before the atomic bombing. He was a radiologist, and during World War II, they were short on X-ray film. So he had to give X-rays to his patients, just turn on the machine and then like diagnose. So, see, he was exposed to a lot of X-rays, and he ended up contracting leukemia. And that's what he died of. So it didn't have, it wasn't actually due to the atomic bombing.
He's such a fascinating and rich character. And obviously, as you were just describing, his interpretation of the bombing as this providential act by God that elevates the suffering of the survivors and the loss of their loved ones to a sort of, you know, cosmic relevance. You can see the kind of comfort that that particular narrative would provide. And it's also, of course, clear how it was after being manipulated and shaped in certain ways, also quite appealing to the occupation officials. And yet, as you were mentioning when you were talking about the archives that you accessed, Nagai's memory is not without complication today. And he's not, maybe it sounds like not everybody would recognize him as the sort of saint-like figure that he might represent to others. So, you know, what are some of the areas where people have disagreed with him? What's his status today, for example, in the collective memory of Nagasaki?
Right. So, yeah, he's still a major figure in Nagasaki, like in bookstores, sometimes there are complete book bookshelves with just his books, and he's still very highly regarded. And that has to do with sort of the last part of chapter three, where I talk about his contributions to Reconstruction. So he was a very well published during the occupation for all the reasons I get into in the book, but you know, partly because he was very appealing to these censors, but for many other reasons. And he used most of his royalties to help the city rebuild physically, made a lot of investments in the city. And so that hasn't been forgotten. But when it comes to, you know, and that's that aspect of his, you know, of his life, still very much in high regard. But as is sort of his interpretation of the bombing among some in the Catholic community, and I should say, you know, after he said this, that became sort of the official stance of the Catholic community, but that didn't mean everyone was on the same page. And there were a lot of critics even within the Catholic community. And one of them I talk about in the book, Akizuki Tatsuichiro, he was a Catholic and he was just like, I just can't abide. That just doesn't make any sense to me. And then other, you know, less influential, you know, Catholic survivors, they didn't know what to make of it, but they thought, okay, well, you know, this is Nagai Takashi. He's our representative. I guess I don't feel right about this, but I guess I have to go along with it. And I don't include this in the book because I found it later, but I don't think I do anyway. It wasn't until after the Pope in the early 1980s, I think, he made an official statement because he kept being asked about this, like, what do you think about this? Is this the work of God? You know, the atomic bombing. And, you know, he never directly criticized Nagai Takashi. And in fact, the popes during the immediate post-war period, you know, admired Nagai Takashi and sent him a rosary and letters and things like that. And so they were communicating. But in the 1980s, the Pope in the early 1980s said that, and this is sort of an indirect criticism of Nagai, but he said, war is the work of man, not God. And when he said that, some of the Catholic hibakusha, the Catholic survivors who were still alive, said that they felt a sigh of relief because they didn't have to think that God had wished this destruction upon them, kind of thing. So yeah, there's, you know, even within the community, there was a lot of, and not a lot, but there was some disagreement. And so a lot of the criticism though comes from scholars. And I actually worked with one of his biggest critics when I was on my Fulbright in Nagasaki. He's a very objective scholar, Takahashi Shinji, and he's published a ton on Nagasaki's post-war history. But, you know, he doesn't, you know, one of his biggest criticisms was something I sort of say matter-of-factly is that, you know, the occupation, the Allied occupation censors found his work palatable because it did sort of exempt the responsibility of the United States. That's Takahashi's work. And so I agree with that. He does go on to criticize him a little more about, you know, from like a theological perspective and things, but that was enough to, you know, cause a rift between Takahashi, the scholar, and some in the Catholic community, especially, there were some responses from some officials in the Catholic community, published responses, the responses to the criticisms, I actually don't talk about this in the book, but a lot of the responses to the criticisms of Nagai Takashi, so the responses from the Catholic community all say the same thing, and that, or in one way or another, and they say that you can't criticize them outside of a theological perspective, or you can't criticize them from outside the religious context of Catholicism. And I guess that's sort of trying to remove historical context from the discussion, but that's sort of the back and forth about his interpretation.
That's fascinating. And there's so much in the book, and I'm afraid we'll have to sort of gloss over some of this.
That's all right. The people will just have to buy the book.
Well, of course, that goes without saying. But I think we'd be remiss in not talking about the larger community of survivors that you mentioned. And actually, I think maybe the best way to, you have really two chapters where you delve into their different, you know, contesting visions of the municipal authorities that you talked about earlier and, you know, coming into conflict with the occupation's priorities and so on. But I think the case study that you discuss in detail in the last chapter is maybe a great way to symbolize some of that that sort of contested process. Just tell us about the controversy over the decision to demolish the Urakami Cathedral in 1958 and what that represents about this community.
Yeah, great. So in chapter six about the ruins of the Urakami Cathedral, really came down to sort of a battle over the wishes of the survivor activist groups to preserve the ruins as this memento of the destruction, and the wishes of the Catholic community, which had their own vision of reconstruction, which was complete renewal of their community spiritually as well as physically. And so the ruins of this cathedral stood as a literal obstruction to realizing that vision. And so this, in the last chapter, you actually get sort of these two groups pitted against one another, unfortunately. And I should also say, like, you know, this had this sort of a little bit of tension between the two groups and their visions for, I guess I should say now, like, the urban identity of the city. How much does the atomic bombing factor into that identity? Their desires for that were also separate, and that sort of began really with Nagai Takashi. And so he became the representative voice of his community, yes, but during the occupation, his books were such bestsellers. The number one bestseller in Japan in 1948 was one of his books, and so he became not only the voice of the Catholics but the voice of Nagasaki in general, the voice of the representative voice of the city's atomic bombing experience, you know. And that wasn't a representative that the survivors and the survivor activists had chosen. But that sort of becomes what I call like a wall of silence. So this would prevent their voice from really getting outside of the city as a group, the survivor activists as a group. And so when you get to the end of the book with chapter six, I'm showing how this, you know, played out in the late 1950s, you know, after about a decade of, you know, these survivor activists trying to work against these walls of silence. And I discussed the municipal vision of reconstruction as one other wall of silence. But and so now you have a literal wall, a ruin that they're sort of fighting over. And this is where a lot of the groups come together. I mean, by now the occupation is gone, but the other three groups, you know, this is where they all sort of are coming together, and where you see the clash of visions and the sort of combination of others. And in the end, of course, and spoiler alert, the walls of the cathedral, so the ruins, are removed completely, and a brand new cathedral is built in its place. And so the survivor activist groups are really upset about this because they lost one of their, it was actually the symbol, the atomic bombing symbol of the city, you know, for 13 years. It was, you know, many people are familiar with the atomic dome or the peace dome in Hiroshima. And so it would often appear alongside that in magazines and newspapers and things like that. And so, and it was a one of the main sites of atomic tourism in Nagasaki. It was where all the, they held ceremonies and things like that. And so this was a huge loss for the memory activism of the Hibakusha, the survivors, but it was a huge win for the Catholics for a lot of different reasons. One is they're getting to realize their vision of reconstruction, which meant a complete renewal of their landscape. And secondly, they're getting back their center of the community. And so that was their lobbying point the whole time, was that, you know, we don't have a center of our community anymore, and because the cathedral was the center of their community, and we need it back. And they rejected all sorts of proposals to, you know, build a brand new cathedral on a separate plot of land. The city, if I remember correctly, even offered them a plot of land to do that, or to sort of build a new cathedral incorporating the ruins from the old cathedral. And that was something that was done in Berlin with the Gedächtniskirche. The Catholics just rejected all proposals because they really wanted to remove those ruins. Yeah.
No, I think it's such a fascinating case study, and it really demonstrates the politics of memory, that this process of commemorating heroic past or a tragic past is always embroiled in the politics of the moment. And it brings out all of the different competing interests of so many different groups that make it, but any urban or rural or national community. So it's a fascinating case study. And then you go on to talk about some of the decisions that were made even after the demolition of and the rebuilding of the cathedral, the ways in which the commemoration in Nagasaki that maybe some of our listeners might be familiar with, the famous statue that's in the right. Peace Park there, how that still doesn't quite meet doesn't rise to the standards of some of the memory activists that you talk about in those last two chapters.
Yeah, no. It was the way that the municipal government continued to choose to commemorate the atomic bombing was always insufficient from the perspective of the survivor activists. And the statue that you mentioned is just one example, and I'll mention others in a second. But so in 1955, they installed a statue for tens of millions of yen at a time when a lot of the survivors are living in poverty. They can't pay for their medical costs. So one, they see it as a waste of municipal funds that could have been used to improve their lifestyles or their standards of living. And two, anybody can just go Google the Nagasaki statue, and this will probably come up. It's the giant, now he's green, and he's like pointing to the sky and then pointing flat out to his left, I guess. And it the biggest criticism in terms of describing the statue that the survivors had was that it doesn't capture the trauma of the atomic bombings. But like, what is he doing? I mean, there is an explanation for why he is pointing and things like that, but like he's pointing to the sky for the atomic bombing and his other hand is pointing the way to peace. But the atomic bombing survivors just hated it. But it becomes the center of commemoration to this day. And this is they still hold the annual commemorations right in front of that statue to this day. And I guess that's another aspect of it, is the annual commemorations are often a point of contention between the survivor activists and the municipal officials pretty much ever since they began officially in 1948 and into the present. But in 1947, for example, the municipal officials decided not to hold a city-sponsored commemoration, and instead they held a week-long trade festival to sort of play up their history of international trade, and they were asked about it by reporters, and they gave all these elusive answers like Tokyo made us do it, but they didn't really have any good explanation. And I argue something in the book, and that's in chapter one if anybody wants to read that. But definitely the way that the city is, on the official level, the municipal officials have chosen to commemorate the atomic bombing, is constantly a point of contention. So.
And I think actually you sort of just alluded to the fact that even though the number of people who have direct memory of the bombing is dwindling and getting smaller and smaller, it's still a live issue in Japan, and that's really the way you conclude in the end of the book. And you you end with a disturbing story about efforts by the city officials in the last few years to limit the ability of the hibakusha and other activist groups to continue having a voice and to sort of frame in their own way how they choose to commemorate their own past. And it's a wake-up call to realize that the way that this discourse is still being manipulated in the present. And I wonder, at the risk of ending on sort of a downer note here, drawing on the insights that you've gained from your research into this subject, how do you think that discourse is likely to develop in the coming years?
Yeah, it's a really good question that I constantly find myself thinking about it, even though this project has been done for a while. I always try to pay attention to the annual commemorations to see how it is developing, but because the survivors do often use, so the survivors generally have a representative that's always been an atomic bombing survivor give a speech at the annual ceremony on August 9th, and they've often used it as an opportunity to criticize different administrations. Like recently, they criticized the Abe administration for a lot of different reasons, and the city officials didn't like that, or at least were, that's not how they put it, but they don't like that, and so they've devised a way to try to dampen their voice, and eventually they're going to completely eliminate their voice from the commemoration. But they developed this this committee a couple of years ago. I'd have to reread my conclusion, but a committee of five people. Two of them were supposed to be survivors, but on the initial committee, I don't think there were any. I'd have to double check that. But to choose the representative out of, and people were supposed to submit applications to say, "I want to be a representative to give this speech." And but the fear, of course, from the activist groups is that, well, they're being pushed out from the committee to select their own representative, and two, this person that will be selected may not speak on behalf of the survivor activists' goals or viewpoints. But this is happening at the same time the city officials are, again, really pushing this international past that we've been talking about, and which is the subject of so much of the book. They're doing it again. The current mayor, Tawe, and I can't remember if I mentioned this in the book, but a few years ago, he did sort of a tour in the U.S. when he was going on his way to the meetings at the U.N. that they go to every year. But he did this sort of mini tour where they were talking about, Nagasaki's urban identity, essentially. And, they start out with all the international history, and then only secondly, they eventually get to the atomic bombings. But they're really pushing the urban identity of the city that they've been cultivating really since September 1945 when they began discussing it. But in terms of where I see this going, I do keep in contact with a very close friend of mine who's been keeping me updated, and he actually used to work for the mayor's office before he retired, and he's very supportive of the Hibakusha, even if the offices always aren't. And so I do pick his brain sometimes, and I mean, sad to say, it's not looking good for the representative voices of the Hibakusha groups going forward. But we'll see what happens.
Well, it just demonstrates how the historical legacy of World War II continues to remain quite potent in East Asia in ways that people outside of the region sometimes find it easy to forget about. So our work continues to be cut out for us.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, there's so much that I think we had to really gloss over, and particularly I would have liked to talk more about the various aspects of the memory activism of the Hibakusha in the post-war era, but we'll have to leave that rich material for the listeners to go back and delve into, and I, of course, really encourage them to do so, because it's a fascinating study, really immersed in a rich body of primary sources, and I think our listeners will really enjoy it. Now is the time on the series when we traditionally shift gears and wrap things up here by asking you, now that you've finished this work that really goes back to the beginning of your studies in Japan, what are you working on now?
Oh, yeah. So I'm working on a couple of things. One article and a new book. The article kind of grew out of this, but it really grew out of a course I teach here at Loyola on the atomic bombings. And it's an article that I'm calling Melodies of Memory, Framing Japanese War Narratives in 1950s Film. And it's really a film history, film studies piece about, I'm looking at the 1950s and three films in particular, a 1953 film called Hiroshima by Sekigawa Hideo. And then, of course, I'm looking at Godzilla, because any excuse to look at Godzilla and talk about it So that's 1954. And then a French New Wave film that's very famous, Heroes from Monomore by Alain Resnais, 1959. I'm just looking at these three films and looking at filmmakers as memory activists. And so filmmakers, directors, producers, actors, of course, music composers. And I'm defining all of them as filmmakers. And I'm looking at how they worked together to craft war narratives or support war narratives or in the face of like really powerful political interests like U.S.-Japan relations and things like that. And it's, you know, it's and you know, and depending on how long this article gets, I am looking at a lot of other films because these filmmakers aren't restricted to just these three films. You know, the music composer that I'm looking at, Ifukube Akira, he did both Hiroshima and Godzilla, but he also did a lot of other post-war films, a lot of them dealing with the wartime war films.
Yeah, that sounds like a fascinating project. And you mentioned also a new book project you have in mind.
So the new book is growing out of a seminar paper I wrote at Columbia about tattooing in Tokugawa Japan, but I broadened it to look at late Tokugawa through the end of World War II, and not just tattooing in Japan, but I'm concerned mostly with what I'm calling the peripheries. Oh, I'm not the only person to call them the peripheries, but like the people on the peripheries of Japan and the people who eventually become Japanese colonial subjects, the Ainu, the people of Okinawa, Taiwan. I eventually want to get into Korea as well, but so tentative title is Embodying Empire, Tattoos, Judo, and the Corporeal Experiences of Japanese Subjects, 1799 to 1948. And you'll notice that I threw in judo. And that's because what I want to do is, you know, there's been plenty written about the influence of the Japanese colonial empire on the customs of the people in the colonies, you know, forcible language instruction, history instruction, things like that. But I'm more concerned with like the physical corporeal experience of the people and what, you know, what could be more physical than tattoos and judo. And I, so I practiced judo, throughout my entire time living in Japan. It's one of the most physically demanding exercises you can do. And so and I know from experience, it affects your physical body and changes your physical body. And so what I want to look at in this book is how do the physical bodies of the colonial peoples change because of empire?
All right. Well, these both sound like great projects and sounds like you're continuing your tradition of very creative and engaging titles. So, So we'll be looking forward to seeing more of your work in publication soon. I'd just like to thank you again for taking this time to discuss your book with me today. And again, I'd really like to endorse it for the readers. It's a stimulating and very thought-provoking read, and I really enjoyed talking about it with you today.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me about the book.
All right. Thanks a lot, and take care.